This episode is brought to you by Max. The new HBO original limited series, The Sympathizer, is an espionage thriller and cross-culture satire that follows a communist spy during the final days of the Vietnam War and his new life as a refugee in Los Angeles. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr. and based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Sympathizer is streaming now exclusively on Max. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com, tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else.
On this episode, I chat with former Exeter Chiefs strength and conditioning coach. He's been through everything with Exeter on the rise, winning the Premiership, winning the European Cup, and also the Saracen scandal. It's the powerful, the wonderful, the legendary James Parks.
Big Jim is wearing his heels, marching around the town to get some thrills. But it's time to go in now, and he's big and red. A shot of black cap, and now he's super dead. He gets loused on the beer day gals. A shoulder of some whiskey, and he shoots it's like a ball.
Parksy, talk us through your journey in rugby, not as a player, which was very good, but more so at Exeter. Like, you had 9-10 years there. Were you there when they were crap?
I was incredibly fortunate. It all coincided with me leaving a job because I didn't get on with somebody in rugby league. And a seminal moment for me where I stood up for the values that I believe in. I was like, look, I don't like the way this guy treats people, so off I went, and I was really fortunate that an opportunity came up at Exeter. I grew up in the southwest. I went to Ivebridge Community College, which is just down the road as well, where a few of us came through there, and it was an opportunity to go home, which was incredible. My first year there was their third year in the Prem. For some unbeknown reason to me, it was just like jumping on a rocket ship, and everything there was founded on real solid foundations and gave us the opportunity to, year after year, become more and more successful. I did 9 incredible seasons there with an amazing group of men, players, coaches alike, support staff, office staff. The whole of the way through the club, there was this really, what's the right word? Family's not the right word, but cohesive environment. You'll know this. As things grow, it becomes harder and harder to keep hold of that ethos and make sure everybody knows everybody and knows what their kids' names are and can have those sort of conversations. But when I first arrived, everybody sat in the same office. You pretty much sat on somebody's lap. The infrastructure wasn't what it is today. And I think that closeness has a huge part to play in success, especially when you're building something and coming up through. And yeah, I said 9 incredible years there. At the face of the time that Saracens were incredibly successful as well, there's a bit of a rivalry there now, of course. And yeah, we were fortunate enough to do, say, 6 Prem finals in a row, which is incredible. What a journey. And say some of the memories there. I remember the first time, I remember the last time. And along the way, we got to pick up some silverware as well. And alongside that, those are great things and stuff you'll remember forever. But without doubt, and everyone will talk about this, the people you meet on the way, all of the personalities you get to coincide with, the way you get to see young men turn from these guys who some of them at school or just leaving school coming through and turning into British Lions is, say, something I'm incredibly proud of and very humbled to have been a part of. Absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt. Like, those are the bits that really stick with me.
Yeah, I mean, Exeter is one of them clubs, and with all due respect, even when I was playing, I thought just overachieved all the time. And I say that because I looked at the profile of the team, and at the time we had no idea, like, Luke Cowan-Dickie was going to come through and be one of the best hookers in the world. Jack Noel, for me, is one of the best players in the world. Sam Simmons, etc. The South African contingent as well that's now come in. Don Almond as well, just to name a few. They've obviously signed Hoggy and Johnny Gray. But at that time, playing against Exeter, I was like, how? Like, how is a team in Exeter, I mean, not a place that is synonymous with rugby, in my opinion, although Cornwall is.
Yeah.
Played down there a few times. But when you actually think about it and put it together, Farmers, slightly different, a bit alternative.
Second biggest rugby county in the country, behind Yorkshire, I think. I mean, there's a whole host of factors. No real other competition for playing resource in the immediate area.
Football?
Yep, so limited football. And so there's a lot that paves the way for hugely successful academy and pathways through. And then layer on top of that, Rob's ability to be able to believe what he sees with his own two eyes when he's recruiting, doesn't follow the hype, and has a real strong belief in hard work. And that underpins everything. And when he recruits, that's what he looks for. You know, so does somebody have those innate capabilities that are going to allow somebody to flourish within our environment? Because if they're working hard on the pitch when somebody's not, in inverted commas, not watching, then surely they're going to a certain extent, put the same sort of application into improving, giving the appropriate resources. And the coaches there from top to bottom are fantastically talented and give people a framework to go and make the best out of themselves. And alongside that, people can be themselves there, I think, as well.
What's it like managing these young bucks? And for the listeners, you were you head of strength and conditioning, performance?
No.
Strength and conditioner?
Yeah, I was one of the senior strength and conditioning coaches at the club. I was the shortest serving member of the team there at 9 years, which gives you an idea of the consistency that program's had over the course of time. So Mark Twiggs was my lead, and there's some other great people there, Rob Bedard, Nick Cox, etc. So we made up the sort of heart of the strength and conditioning team.
Which is the heart of, I always say, like the physios and the strength and conditioning team are not undervalued, but undervalued maybe in the public domain of the importance and the amount of work and the amount of graft and the amount of, I imagine it's so small in terms of margin, being able to show, I mean, to try and get a player fit or to try and get a player strong, to keep them on the pitch, to get them back from injury. I always saw it as the kind of unseen work that doesn't get the energy that it probably deserves.
Yeah, you don't do it for any reason other than that you hugely value people. You think that they've got an incredible potential to fulfill and you want to help them do that. You're not there for the limelight. That's a certainty. He said and sat in a podcast studio. Hey, you guys. But it's not about that. It's about helping people to get the best out of themselves. And rightly so, the medics are an incredible bunch as well. The amount of emotional energy that they tie into players and people is phenomenal. I haven't got a bad word to say about what they invest in the guys. And the guys understand that. But it's part of being a team. You sign up for that. That's what you're there for. You're there to make sure that when the guys get the opportunity to go out there and be their best selves, that you have given them everything so they can be all they can be. And that, for me, is what it's all about, end of line. And it goes away from, like, it's not just sets, reps, etc. It's also personal relationships, opportunities to be able to, it's a bit of a pastoral role, you know, and you'll know this because you've been there, but they help you through the shit, you know, when things aren't good, when you're not selected, when you're injured, you're playing well and you get dropped, when you've had a row with your missus, when you've got a new kid and you're not sleeping, all of those things are a huge part of it. I look at it as performance, everything outside the rugby domain looks, say, comes under these guys' banners. There are so many taxing things, getting guys to do those little bits of shit that are brutally boring but actually make a difference long term and keep guys fit, healthy, sane and well, so that when that opportunity does arise, they can step out there and unleash this incredible potential that they've got. And I genuinely believe that is our role, as opposed to just the lifting weights and bits, because almost to a certain degree guys could do a large amount of that themselves.
Yeah, so it's a lot of the emotional and mental aspect, because you'd know probably more about these players than the coaches would. And would they tap into you, and how much would you give them? So if you're working with a young lad, maybe he's out of contract, his go-to is to moan, he's miserable, like just his personality, he's like me, basically. Or a sappagizer. I was known as a sappagizer. I had sap, but that, it was that good that it gave people energy.
I'd say flip reverse it.
Yeah. But what's it like with having to manage that? Because there's a lot of pressures, contracts, concussion, when you're in denial about being injured, and
I think
all of the things that go with being a young lad as well now, like mentally.
Yeah, definitely. It's challenging, and different people have, as you say, different habits, different go-tos. It's about understanding people, isn't it? It's about relationships. Say human capital, as we call it, is massively valuable, and something that I personally feel Exeter did a really great job of was bringing in an unbelievable group of human capital and allowing that to go out and do their thing. So it is challenging. But it's also hugely rewarding when you get it right. When you see these guys, seeing somebody go from playing for Brixham first team to playing for the British and Irish Lions, Sam Simmons, to seeing Jack Knoll the day I turned up and I thought he played scrum half because you're so small, to now being a dad of two, just married, British Lion. I can go through more. Sladey, I mean, there's people that aren't there anymore. The Sam Hills, all the guys that gave their everything, the Brett Sturgises. I mean, the list goes on and on. And it's what you get into the job for. It's what you want to be there for, is to help these guys really be everything they can be. And that's hugely rewarding, because for some people, if they didn't have the club or rugby, the end might be quite bleak for them. But it's about getting them to understand and harness all these incredible facets of their being that they have, and utilizing them to be a better version of what they could have been had they not been in your presence or in your care. Because you've seen it, mate. There's some guys that come through, phenomenal players, but loose as fucking anything, you know, say fast and loose. Occasionally they get an opportunity, blow up amazingly well, and then are off the rails. But it's about, if they didn't have these experiences and they were in the outside world, it's about making sure that when they come out of your care, that they're in a better position than they would have been.
Yeah, exactly. I suppose that comes down to the people that they're a part of. When I look at Exeter, well, it's obvious, the stuff that you've just said then, not that the trophies necessarily show you how successful a team is. I know that winning a trophy doesn't say, well, this team is unbelievable because they won a trophy. And that was one of the things at Saracens they spoke about. When it's all said and done, if you don't win a trophy, does that mean that it's been a disaster in the season? No, it doesn't. Let's talk about the stuff that happened at Saracens. Now, yep. I don't know how you feel about it. We've not spoke about it.
No, we haven't.
I wanted to save it on here.
That's fine.
And I'm sticking to my guns.
Yeah. What's your view on it?
Well, I was there.
Yeah, I know. I know you were there, and I was on the other side of the camp.
Yeah, so I got brought into it. For me, at Saracens, right, there always is a bit of smoke and mirrors. Now, I've not told this story before, but why not? Let's share it now. Chat with James Parks. Why not? Let's share it now.
But big day out.
I don't always think there was a natural care for people exactly the same, like, as in 100% for each player. Mm-hmm. It was slowly changing when I was there, because when I signed, Brendan Venter sold me the dream. Edward Griffiths was there. They had a huge South African contingent, the likes of Scout Brits.
Ernst Schubert.
Yeah, Ernst Schubert, Neil de Kock, Botha as well in the second row. They had a kind of core nucleus of players that were all about the people, right? Winning was important, but it was more about these making memories. And when it's all said and done, if you don't win a final, which they didn't the year before I signed, they lost the Prem to Northampton, they lost to Toulon.
Oh, yeah.
And when it's all said and done, does that mean we're not a successful team if we don't win anything? And I thought that was quite powerful.
Yeah.
But it was about making memories. As my time carried on, I realised that was a part of it, of course, but they did want to win things. And in order to win things, there had to be sacrifices within the team.
Yeah.
So players like myself, Kelly Brown, Petrus Duplessis, Jacques Berger, the players that weren't world-class but were very good players got fucking flogged like horses. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? To get to the point where we'd get to the quarters, and we joke about it on the podcast, and when we got to the quarters, the semis and the final...
You have a rest, Jim.
Well, you have a rest, but I could barely walk. You know, it was like I was absolutely fucked by the time I got to there. But it was in order to get Cruz, Itoje, and whoever else.
The worldies.
The world-class players completely brimming for the final. And I'm happy with that. I'm happy that they used me in that. But dynamically, it was like it wasn't, every player was exactly the same.
It was them and us.
And then also, when I reflect on it, when you look at myself, Kelly Brown, Petrus Duplessis, if we are the second string players and we're all internationals, Petrus Duplessis wasn't, but he could have been. He was fantastic, tight head. And you had the ability then to get your top end players fit for the games at the end of the season. As we know, a lot of teams limp into them semis and then finals because of the damage they've taken and 25.
The attrition rate's phenomenal.
Of course. So when I look at that, I can kind of understand where the frustration would be, but from other teams. But for me, the whole thing around money and the whole thing around co-investments, we knew about co-investments and we were never told to shh, shh. We knew about the property thing. So for me, I was looking at it like, brilliant.
Way to make some money.
Yeah, not even make some money. Be looked after, as in get a house in London. It's not like Exeter. Get a house in North London. Well, it might have now. The property rate's gone up. But when I was in it, you know, if I found out that Chris Ashton had half of his house paid for, and I play stupid, but I'm quite diligent when it comes to that. I'm not looking at that thinking, my God, we are doing one over here on Exeter, or we're doing one over.
Everyone else. Or, whoever it may be.
But extra in this point, because you were the coal face for so long. My thing is around the culture environment, and where I find rugby is in a tough place is the reason we've touched on with Exeter, is Saracens, because they were so smart and they were so good in terms of their academy product, bringing the likes of Jamie George, George Cruz, Mara Itoje, Owen Farrell, Nick Tompkins came through that, Alex Goode,
Ben Earl,
players are coming through as well, is, well, you're eating your own success, because how do you reward these guys later on? So I'm thinking you do everything you can to keep these guys, and if it is a case of co-investment? Is it a case of like going halves on a house? I still don't think there's an issue with that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I know I want to chat to you about it because of the reasons we've said. You're at Exeter, you're at the coalface for years and years and years, grafting, not looking for the limelight, but looking for success. When all that came out, how were you?
For me, it's pretty clear and defined. And I've got some really good friends at Saracens from my time there, like Kev Sorrell, very good friend of mine. Joe Shaw, I know reasonably well. There's people that I know there that I've got good relationships with still. But effectively for me, that there was a line drawn whereby it couldn't be crossed. And regardless of the feeling within the camp, which the Saracens people are always entitled to have their own opinions and view on things, every story has two sides. But because it crossed the line of ruling that meant what they did was not seen as lawful, that deconstructed the foundations upon which their success was built. I, for a moment, don't think that anybody else should have been awarded the titles, but I do feel as though those titles should have been removed from history, so to speak, because, and you guys still did the hard work, you still turned up, trained, you still had a group that worked really well together. But for me, within that environment, it's still difficult to see that there was some potential. Fair play is not even probably the right word, is it? There were applications put in place by which the level of player that could be ascertained by that club superseded anything anybody else could potentially put together at that time under the ruling structure that was in place. And that, for me, was the difficult bit.
Yeah, because I don't think it is necessarily, and again, looking back, and it's been 4 or 5 years now, I don't think we're talking about the top-end players that they managed to keep.
No.
I think they're talking about the players like myself, like Kelly Brown, like Petros Duplessis, a number of other players.
You bring these players in and their team's still like, oh my word.
And that was the thing, like we'd go and we'd play
9,000 games a year, I think it was. That's what you quoted, wasn't it?
I played actually for Saracens. I played nearly 80 games, I think, in my 3 years, which is a lot for an old horse. You know,
Shire horses go all right, don't they?
Yeah, it's like, no, they do actually. Not in the modern game, no.
No.
But I mean, I absolutely loved it. And you know what? If the titles were taken away, that wouldn't have, as in my time at Saracens,
wouldn't have changed.
Wouldn't have changed. I wouldn't look back on it any differently. But I'm watching it unfold and I'm like, holy shit.
What the fuck have we done?
As in, what have we done? But then it came out and I was like, we kind of knew this, but I think everyone knew it, didn't they? So, and you've got to think, I reckon the acceleration, in my opinion, happened because Elliot Daly left Wasps to go to Saracens. And I think that that was the one where, I don't know what happened, maybe Elliot Daly got told, look, mate, we'll help you with a house or something like that. I think that was the one with Derek Richardson, the owner of Wasps, is like, right, something needs to happen here. But the lads are going to go to England camp.
Oh, then chat about it.
And maybe that's where, do you know what I mean?
So there was always an awareness, right? Let's not beat around the bush. Everyone questioned how there was such a strong squad put together under the remit of 5 million then, the wage cap with one marquee, I think.
Mm.
Look, I make no bones about it. We were pretty much like, how does this go on and on and on? And I think the longer that you get away with something, the more that you're happy to go out and display those behaviours. And I think maybe that's what happened with Saracens, is that potentially over time, they continued to do what they either thought was or knew wasn't appropriate. And it just caught up with them in the end because it just became too open and too honest.
Mm. So like when we played you in the final, arguably my best cameo ever. Sacked them all. They got a turnover. Yeah, yeah. Back to me.
Still talk about it, don't they? written in the annals of rugby history.
So when you get to that game, like, are you already, as a coach, in the back of your mind, a bit pissed off? Or are you thinking...
I don't think it manifests in that way. I think it's just a case of it leaves a layer of discomfort that makes you wonder what might have been.
But at the time.
At the time, it's detail. It's match day. It's... what have we learned? What do we need to do? How do we prepare? None of that. In the moment, you can't think about that stuff. You need to be wholly focused on the job at hand. And as we both know, those games can still go either way.
Yeah. Which it did in my final year in the semi. But I mean, you know, when we're lifting the trophy and you've given everything, and again, you look at the profile of your team and the superstars were coming through at that point. Are you looking at that and thinking, cunts?
It's a good question. I think that there's a certain level of feeling a little bit undeserved around what potentially might have been. Definitely,
that's a great answer. So basically, the same. Someone from Cov would say,
"Cunt."
Exactly.
No, but like I say, I've got good friends there.
Well, it's not a reflection of us.
It's not a reflection of self. It's a reflection of decisions made by a group. But like I know the England lads get on really well with. Mm. say the Saracens boys on the whole, like they really do, and they feel that's why it's so difficult and such a triggering subject, effectively, because there's a lot of really good friends there. Yet when you talk about that particular time, there is also some difficult conversations, some challenging, courageous conversations that need to be heard.
A little bit of smoke and mirrors. I don't know if I contextualise my story that well of my
environment
at Saracens.
No, I think it makes perfect sense, and maybe because we've both lived on the opposite sides of the fence with it, because I get what you mean exactly. It's about the day to day. It's about climbing the mountain. It's not about when you reach the summit and how you get there necessarily. And those things do matter, of course. That's what you're working towards. You're working towards success. You're working towards creating these amazing memories.
It is hard to have that culture, though, isn't it? Like that Saracens culture, where it's not about winning, even though they've invested, as we know, a lot of money. Mm. Like a lot of owners, yeah. Like the owner of Exeter, yeah, as well, invest a lot of money. Then, even though they said it didn't come down to winning things, it must have come down to winning things. When you've got someone like Owen Farrell in your team. And you've got these.
That boy's unbelievable, isn't he?
In what? In a good way?
A player, unbelievable player.
Yeah, really?
I think he's incredible.
Yeah, I say really, as in, like, I'm interested to hear what other people think of him because.
Mate, born winner.
Well, that's it. Like, but he is, like, an anomaly, really, because he's an individual in a team sport.
Yeah.
And I suppose I'm keen to chat to you about this because working with these individual. And Exeter's very different because you are the ultimate team and. They come from working class backgrounds. Not that if you come from a private school, then you won't have the same mentality. But Owen, for me, was an individual, yeah, happy to be an individual. And you talk about the cultures at Saracens, and I'm happy to share this. Yeah. I genuinely don't think he gave a fuck about me.
Yeah.
I don't think he cared about you. I don't think he cared about his mates in the team. As in, to the point where myself or a Scout Brits or a Jacques Berger.
Yeah.
Has a love just for another human.
Invested in other people.
Exactly. He was all about winning.
Yeah.
And could you imagine what me and him were like? Because I was keen to win. I wanted to win. But it wasn't my be all and end all.
Yeah.
And, you know, I probably could have been a better player if I thought differently around that. When it came to the game,
yeah,
when it came to like that game.
And you're a competitor, weren't you?
Yeah. Well, you saw me play, like, yeah, as in that. It was everything. I put my body on the line. Like, I literally I crawled out of the game. But he is just a different human. And during lockdown, watching the Jordan doc, I'm not likening him to Michael Jordan, but the psyche and how Jordan spoke to his teammates.
Yeah.
I watched Ronaldo the other week, went to watch Man United Arsenal. Me and my son were desperate to watch him play. I think he's the best player to have played the game.
Yeah.
I'm watching him shouting at his teammates. Even if he made a mistake, he's done a shit pass, yeah, and it's gone. And he's like blaming his mates. And I'm thinking, maybe it was me.
Nah.
You know, maybe this is what it's about. And you need, of course you need these people in the game.
I think everyone treads a different path, right? And everybody's route to success is paved on previous experience within their life, and that's what led you to where you were. And it'll be the same for Owen, right? Like, how often is your dad the best rugby player in English history?
No one ever.
Exactly. And I don't know the bloke from Toffee, but I've just got a huge admiration for his competitive nature. And when he plays, Saracens are a better team, and he gets stick about different bits and pieces, but like, I personally just hugely admire the fact that he's willing to go out there and absolutely give everything bar nothing. Because I don't know, and you can probably tell, I don't suspect he's the best athlete you've ever seen, but I bet he's the hardest worker.
Well, you can see he's not. You can see visually, aesthetically, he's not.
But God, he gives himself to the cause, and I've got a huge amount of respect for that.
He's a northerner.
Yeah.
They're hard, aren't they?
They're hard as nails, mate. Yeah, hard as nails.
They are. They're built with something different. I remember one of the coaches, and it was a great analogy. He was like, Jim, you need to work on your tackling, your catch, your pass, your speed.
Your rugby.
Your power. Basically, you've got a million things to work on to be a decent rugby player. Owen needs to be working on emotional
intelligence.
Like, as in, like, and I said, he's got one thing to work on.
I've got them all.
Actually, when you look at it, and again, not that I dealt with it any differently, but I'm intrigued now being a dad and trying to give them tools to be good in life and be better in life and to be able to migrate through this fucking unbelievable
be good humans.
Exactly. And I look at it and it's like, when it's all said and done, would I want it to be a Michael Jordan or a Dennis Rodman? Do you know what I mean? I was neither.
You got tats like Rodman.
Well, that's as close as it gets.
That's all right, though. Yeah. Doing better than me, mate.
I think he's got his nipple pierced as well. I might go
for
that.
Hey, let's do it.
Absolutely.
After the show, we're going to get him done.
Yeah, absolutely. You talk about elitists, and Owen Farrell would have been in that bracket. A number of the Exeter players as well. You look at something we spoke about after is alcohol and drinking in rugby as players and athletes. when I was at Leicester back in the day, I mean, back in the day, it was professional. But the time where Martin Johnson was there, Neil Back,
yeah.
Roundtree, Cockrell, Garforth,
ABC Josh Club.
Yeah, exactly, as in it was proper. Yeah. My goodness me, did we have a drink. On a Wednesday night, Saturday after the game, Sunday, we play Monday. I was captain of the A-League on a Monday.
Legend.
I know, absolutely. Hey,
mate, A-League games, I think I've got more A-League caps than anyone could ever count, but A-League at Welford Road was unbelievable.
It was. I mean, we'd get 10,000, 15,000.
Yeah, I know. I remember.
And referencing Matt Hampson's book, he said that Jim Hamilton was our leader off the pitch and on it.
Framed that on the wall in
exactly.
the loo.
I don't know. Loo. Someone else told me it was in there, but yeah. I'm going to stick with it.
Bullshit.
But I know. Is that no chance? But with the drinking culture then, and there was a drinking culture at Saracens, apart, you know, and Owen forced himself into that as well. And that I'm saying his name because we've just spoken about him, but. In the elite athlete and performer, Exeter.
Yeah.
The rumours were loved a pint or 10.
Yeah. So
if you can share the stories.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's about stories, but it's about, I think over the course of time, things change as well. And as you get closer to achieving success, you manipulate and tweak different things to ensure that you hopefully get the best out of people at the right time. Without doubt, one of the most essential ingredients in a successful team, especially rugby, is a coherent group. Alcohol plays a part in that, because it allows people to release inhibitions and do things that make them more themselves and feel more comfortable.
Yeah.
So it gives you that opportunity to say to be your authentic self in front of others. And
do you think that is when you have a drink?
Well, release your inhibitions, say,
yeah.
Of course it does. Like, without doubt, like you're just a bit more comfortable, aren't you? It's a bit easier. And it doesn't have to be 50,000 all the time. Like a few drinks sometimes is really nice and you just get a bit giddy and excited and you go and have a great time. Or it might be where we were fortunate enough to go away for our pre-season trips and have a couple of nights just to go and learn about people and experience each other in a more relaxed environment. So you can find out what makes them tick, what makes them talk and what makes them punch, you know, depending on the spectrum of where people are or how they're wired. And I do think that there is definitely a time and a place, and to be able to manage that time and place appropriately is really important, because I'm a coach. They're not going to tell me everything, but you get a fair idea. It's definitely not Wednesday, Saturday, Sunday. There's a lot of guys with families, kids, other responsibilities now as well. Yes, it's important. Yes, it was utilized. The majority of the time, I think it was done at the right time. Sometimes some people did it at the wrong time, but I don't necessarily think that is the founding member of success. I think it's a part of the complex puzzle that, say, we need to put together to ensure we get groups to be coherent, driving towards the same purposeful ending that we're looking to try and achieve. And that can be across a whole spectrum of things. It can be what works for you. Why did you want to be out there giving your all? Was it for your family, your friends, yourself, your ego? Was it for the club, the money, the respect, the fame? You know, and there's so many different things, and different people coming from the islands who are doing this to support their families back home. We've got guys who are doing this because they just found they're really good and they don't really like rugby that much, but it's quite a nice way to get a start in life. And you get some guys who just love being in a group and bring everyone together. So I think too much importance can be placed in it, but there is definitely a time and place for it, that it can be the match that lights the fuse, which allows that rocket ship to take off.
Protein shakes and all the things that go into that. I reckon protein, along with painkillers, my guts are still in fucking pieces now. I mentioned James Gaisbrook earlier. Like, he was on the protein shakes, like 3 scoops of whey protein every morning.
14 times a day.
Yeah, a bit of creatine.
Yeah.
Mate, my guts, it just, like, used to wreck them, but...
Yeah.
I mean...
Definitely. Protein is one of the... There's a few supplements which we know have a benefit, right? So that are registered and we know are authentic and can create some sort of appropriate benefit to us. Protein's one of them, but it, like, mate, so similarly... It just doesn't sit well with some people. And it just, because it's to a certain extent pre-digested, it's not whole, therefore bypasses some of the breakdown and the enzymes which our bodies produce. And that can obviously play havoc with our stomachs. I similarly have had similar experiences. Some of the boys' guts just get absolutely torn apart. And they say the same, the diclofenac and all the anti-inflams. Absolutely terrible. There's no sort of long-term research on it. The protein seems safe as safe can be, but it just isn't a nice process to be able to go through. But for some of these guys, these supplements are essential because they can't eat enough to be appropriately sized to be able to compete with some of these guys or to be able to maximise their potential. So,
what would you need to eat? So if you've got a protein shake, so let's go back. If Skaze is having 3 or 4 mm-hmm. scoops of protein, whatever the numbers of that are, what's that equivalent to if he's having a shake in the morning before he gets out of bed?
Yeah, so to take on enough protein per day, it's 2 to 2.5 grams per kilogram of body mass per day. And that, those are extreme numbers. It goes, the literature ranges anywhere from like 0.8 to 2.5. But bodybuilders, they do like 2 to 2.5 grams of protein. So you're looking at, for human beings, so 100 kilo bloke wants to increase his lean mass size. He's looking to 200 to 250 grams of protein a day to take in. You think a protein shake's 20 grams, and then you've got to supplement the rest with eggs, food, meat, and you've got to digest that, take that on board. You've got to be able to have enough rest between so you can get out and train. That's like, it's not super simple. It takes a fair bit of eating. And then obviously that's why guys utilize the supplements, because it's just an easier road to getting to where they need to be. And you know what rugby players are like. They're like, give me a number, I'll hit it. And then they go away, and off they do, and they find a way to do it. And often that is through utilising supplementation. But let's say, let's hope that in some cases we know that young people can be influenced inappropriately with that and make poor decisions. But generally in this country, it seems pretty reasonably safe. Most people make good decisions, whereas like we hear in South Africa, Craven Week, they're finding 4, 5, 6 lads using anabolic steroids.
Yeah, I was chatting about Craven Week with my mate Roddy Grant. Yeah. Because you look at the South African build on them, and it's easy to say, oh, they've been on steroids. But there's not all of them have. I know that that's not the case. It's the Afrikaners, the fact that they've been brought up on farms and eaten bulls since they were
and
born.
And stretched.
Very, very, I mean, they're just unbelievable athletes, aren't they? That I always say, if you're struggling as a team, I said to my mate Deeks at Leicester, struggling to get on the front foot, struggling for anything, struggling in the collision, sat on a couple of South Africans.
Have you seen that boy, that Jasper Visa?
Unbelievable.
What a season.
I had a few beers with him in Wales, actually.
Did you?
This was the thing during the pandemic and the whole thing around Scotland. They weren't allowed to have a beer after Ali Price had his 50th cap against Italy. Yeah, that was in the Six Nations. Yeah, in the autumn, me and Goody are doing a live show in Cardiff. Midweek Wednesday, they've got South Africa got Wales at the weekend. Jasper Visa, Mostar, a load of the other lads having a few beers. Willie LaRue, midweek, a few beers. Not mad.
Yeah, but that's the thing.
Maybe just 10. I rocked up at the weekend. They are like...
Different breed.
They are. Yeah. They are built for a beer. Because before, historically, and you'd be the same, Islanders were the ones. You'd just put Islanders in your team. And then you'd get on the front foot and you could do worldly things. Yeah. For me, if I'm a coach, I'm bringing in South Africans.
Yanis Kirsten, Jacques Vermeulen.
There you go. Just to name two, but you could go through all of them. Hester Hazen, Harlequin's best player. He's going to be playing for South Africa again, for sure.
There's so many of them.
Liebenberg, Jasper Visa. You look at the lads, the Dupree brothers at Sale. You look at Lou Diega. You look at Delande at Munster.
My goodness.
Then you look at Paul Willemser, who's French, but South African. Exactly. Yeah. I mean,
monsters.
Yeah. I mean,
and then you look at the South African side, and there's another 23 of them that we're not even talking about, who are phenomenal.
But the pressure, and this is what I was chatting to Roddy about, like if you're in South Africa in a country like that where there's nothing, I mean, I love South Africa as a country, but my goodness me, it's not even on its knees, it's on its back.
Man, I lived there for 12 years. Sad state of affairs. Sad state of affairs. Incredible country, beautiful, amazing place. Wouldn't take my kids there.
Well, they don't, do they? Yeah. They most of them stay. Or
yeah, it's mad, isn't it?
Live in France or use the opportunity.
So sad.
It's crazy, isn't it? I mean, the pressures that they're under as young lads, and I know Craven Week is the one well documented. I read an article on the BBC before around some of the lads have been done for steroids. Yeah. And what are they, 16 years old?
Yeah, 16 to 18.
You don't hear of stuff like that in the UK, do you? I know there's been a few in...
Individual cases in rugby league as well, a little bit more.
Yeah, in rugby league. Again, you could see why, like in rugby league, that... playing that sport and the size, but in union we're pretty clean, are we not?
It seems pretty good, yeah. So by all accounts in this country, there's been very few, the odd case in Wales.
Yeah.
Funny old thing in the valleys, out of the valleys. But no, generally it's been well looked after. And education is an important part of it. And I think that probably falls hand in hand with the demographics that play rugby. And I mean that in no other way than it's the reality of the fortunate position which people who play rugby are often brought up in.
There's a social aspect to it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that through that, we've been quite fortunate to be exposed to the do's and don'ts and why they're important and what not standing up for those rulings can do to you in terms of ruining your career. And I mean, if you can do it without steroids, Jim, anyone can, right?
Jesus, just genetics, mate.
Pure genetics. Stretch Armstrong himself, right?
Freak genetics. I didn't do weights until I was 17. And actually, ironically, the first place I did weights was in South Africa. So Leicester sent me there to go and join this South African Institute of Rugby.
Really?
And we thought it was a training
I think they thought it was a joke.
So in Australia, well, it was a joke because what we were doing was basically it was an academy for referees. So we were sitting in these auditoriums, me, my mate Deeks, who's now the Leicester coach, a guy called Lee Morley, who's over in Australia now, and some Welsh lads. And we were in this auditorium every day. We're in this auditorium every single day. And they're talking to us about, like, how rugby balls are made, how whistles are made. We're like, what the hell is
this?
What
have they sent us to?
So we basically reached out to someone at the Institute and said, look, this ain't for us. Like, Leicester have sent us here. They don't know what they've signed us up to. We're mongrel mob. We're from Leicester. We just want to throw some tin around, even though I'd never thrown tin around. Anyway, it went from that to where I ended up with Deeks. He was injured the whole time.
Which Deeks, Louis or Brett?
Brett. Two of the hardest blokes who've ever done it. But we went from doing that to having one-on-one training with Ollie LaRue, who was the Springbok prop.
Yeah, I remember him.
So he'd take us down the beach every Friday to do an Ironman, which you had to run peer-to-peer, swim around the pier, do these mad exercises on the beach, train with him on a Friday. At the weekends, we'd train with a guy called Kevin Barry, who was the Natal Sharks and Springbok conditioning coach. We were taking supplements, legit. Bit of creatine back then.
Bit of biltong.
Of course, yeah. 100%. Just eating constantly. I mean, the meat's so cheap there. And I went from being in South Africa, having not done any weights in my backyard in Coventry and Leicester. And when I came back there, the development of having that strength and conditioning, well, it was not even comparable. It was like, that's what it was. It made me, well, I still couldn't run, but I was naturally strong as an ox. But that was it. Like that, at that age of 17, 18, and that training, that time in South Africa.
How long were you there for? A week.
Yeah, exactly. It felt like a week. I was there for just under a year. We got run out.
Really?
We ended up having a big scrap and we had to leave. So in a car park at my old rugby club, DHS Old Boys.
Yeah.
And we'd gone there, and because I wasn't about the training, I was about playing. So I was ended up playing for DHS Old Boys, and we were out one night, and I'd basically taken the position of, what was that second row at Exeter who was in the team, the old school, for years and years?
Well, Tommy Hayes?
Tommy Hayes. Yep. So I'd basically come in and taken Tommy Hayes' position, right? Okay, young lad coming through. Tommy Hayes was at the end, and we were out one night in a nightclub in Durban, Night Fever, 20 rand to get in, so it was about £2 to get in all you could drink. And this lad, it's calling Tommy Hayes, makes a beeline for me and starts on me in this nightclub. And he's pissed out of his head because obviously I've taken this position, but he's never said.
Not for you to stand down from a confrontation ever, Jim.
But at this point, these are my teammates, I never did. So Deeks gets involved and Deeks gets in the middle and he's like, mate, like, what's the fucking problem here? Anyway, Tommy Hayes swings at him and then Deeks steps back and, as we know,
launches
left uppercut.
Sleeping.
Knocks this lad clean out. This lad is like a legend.
Was.
Of the team. Was a legend. We don't think anything of it. We carry on the night, go out, eat our Broekvoort sausages. And as we get back to the house, all the lads are queued up in their bloody 4x4s.
You kidding me?
Waiting for us to get there. They'd gone in, they'd wrecked the joint. They'd pulled this lad called Owen Williams, who played for Wales Sevens and Cardiff, ripped him out of his bed. His missus was there, Angie. And we're like, taxi driver, drive. So the taxi driver's taken us, and it's like, where am I? I said, take us to the owner of the club's house. So he took us to the owner of the club's house, and the club, the lad Michael Spinks was a scrum half for the club.
Yeah.
His dad was the owner, and his dad was like, look, if there's an issue, you need to go to the rugby club and sort it out. Like, you need to get there and fucking deal with it like men. So I'm thinking, Jesus Christ. So the taxi driver has dropped at the house, and Michael Spinks' dad has taken us to the club in his Range Rover. Get to the club, and I mean, it was £2 all you can drink, so I'm absolutely bothered.
Flying.
I remember going into the car park, they're all stretching. All the lads are stretching.
Ready for the bleep test.
And I'm like, fucking here we go. But it's right, we got Deeks, we got Morley, these lads can scrap. But these lads hadn't played at the club. I was playing. They were injured and they are doing whatever, doing a bit of training. Yeah. So I remember opening the door and they're like, get out of the fucking car. I remember getting out of the car and I know them. I've walked towards the captain.
Yeah.
And next thing, someone's hit me. Let's just say it was a scaffolding pole. Someone's hit me that hard. Apparently, I'm like,
good night.
I'm starfished on the floor.
Gone.
So I don't see anything. But the story goes, they're trying to get Deeks out of the car and he is uppercutting them from the car. So, like, not even a standing start. And they're dropping. They're dropping like flies. Police turn up, mace everyone. And then next thing we know, me and Deeks are in the back of the car, back of the police car. I've got pictures at home on my wall of us, like, my nose is across my face. My lips are literally five times the
bubble
size. Gun. I know, Deeks, not a scratch on him. He goes home. Back to Leicester to play. I end up staying. And they were like, they're all shaking my hand. Like, they thought I was an absolute legend because I took a pasting.
That hell of a story. No wonder you got a storyteller on your biography.
Of course, that's what it is. Yeah, Jesus. True story. And the weird thing was, maybe 10 years later, I was in Leicester, and the lad that was captain of the club, Ludi, his name was, like, comes up to me and asked her.
You're kidding me?
Oh, I remember me. And I was like, my last memory
was you smacking me.
It wasn't him. Me walking towards you and someone hit me with a scaffolding pole.
Jeez.
So, yeah, that was... Hey, fucking make a man of you.
Oh, wouldn't it just? That's all I know. I never even played rugby in South Africa, funnily enough. I didn't start till I moved to England. But you played on surfaces of, like, concrete.
Well, this was a cricket pitch that we were basically playing on.
Ooh, hold up. Smell test. Go ahead. Sniff those pits. Now, your bits. Feet, toes, come on. Ugh. Could be fresher, right? It's all good. Old Spice Total Body Deodorant Spray is gentle enough to use all over your body, giving you 24/7 lasting freshness with daily use, from pits to toes and down below. So every smell test gets a... Shop for Old Spice Total Body Deodorant.
With Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot, you can get up to $2,300 off select kitchen packages from top brands like GE Profile. That means you can save on a new GE Profile smart quad door refrigerator that's full of convenient features like a dual dispense autofill pitcher and an ice dispenser with up to 12.5 pounds capacity. Bring convenience to your kitchen with smart, innovative appliances from GE Profile. Right now, save up to $2,300 on select kitchen packages with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration needed for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 2, 200, or 2 million, Atlassian software is built to keep you connected and moving together as one.
So good though, like summer rugby. Yeah, like phenomenal.
You were built for summer rugby, right?
Oh,
wasn't he?
I'm literally chomping at the bit for summer rugby.
Now you've retired.
I don't know what. Maybe you can help me with your medical knowledge of background.
Yeah.
Like, I sleep with the window open, right? Yeah. When I'm on holiday, I don't like sunbathing. I overheat.
Yeah.
If it was anything over 10 degrees, I am struggling.
Like a
St.
Bernard.
Like, genuinely like that. Like, as in all the fur but no hair.
Yeah.
Is that a thing, is it?
Like, yeah, can't help you on that one. Jim Burt, say, holidays sound terrible to me.
Oh,
for you.
God.
Absolutely. Skiing, take up skiing.
Summer rugby, would you be up for it?
Yeah, 100%. I think the...
But what about cricket?
What about cricket?
Bloody hate cricket.
I think the fantastic asset that guys spend so much time training now, there's a huge improvement in the number of skilled players around. It's definitely built for it. So I think that's a... Like, it's got to be a win. And more so, a centralised season, so both hemispheres playing at the same time.
Oh, God. You're opening another can of worms there.
Oh, we love that, don't we? It makes sense, doesn't it? Surely. Oh, like, 100%. People always say to me, say sometimes the most obvious things are just simply looking you in the face, and to have a centralised season. And it would allow for democratisation of the game across the international scene as well, because you could rotate, so you could play a superpower, you could play Tier 2 nation, and... It would enable you not to have the same cycles year on year out in terms of who you play and the same old faces, etc.
What's the optimal amount? And I've got a number in my head, and it was interesting talking to Ebenezer Beth, who's at the top of his game, an absolute warrior. He's got a number in his head, he told me, of the number of games maximum you should be playing. If you're a top level, say you're a British and Irish line, but more an international player.
Whoa.
Just roughly, I know... Like, as
again,
in...
I think it's very different for different people. What you'll see is, and you again will have come across this firsthand, is some people can just do it. Some people can go bang, 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 game.
And they need that.
Yeah, and some people can play 2, 3, or 4, have a break, 2, 3, or 4.
What would be the max number? So
20 to 25, something like that.
There you go. So you've got the same number in your head
as
me, and you've got the same number in your head as Ebenezer Beth, and you've got the same number in your head as a lot of people that I know. I think 20 to 25, 25 if you're one of them durable players that can go week on week, should be the absolute max you should play.
Yeah.
Because in that way, and then however that season goes, whether or not it's split and you've got the Six Nations and then you've got a season, so say the season was changed and say the Six Nations was the start, I suppose, of the season, and then it was delayed for everyone else that wasn't playing internationals and the season started then and you went through that kind of lovely summer barbecues, beers with your mates.
Oh, I haven't got any mates, but beer's great.
You would do, though.
I would do, wouldn't I?
Yeah, you would. Hey, if the sun was out, you'd have a few mates. You just stand there and enjoy a cold beer.
God,
and then you finish the season with the autumn or the spring series if you're down in the Southern Hemisphere. And then that's it. And then you have that break.
I don't even think there has to be a lead-in with the Six Nations. I just think start them at the same time. And then those young players get the opportunity to get that time.
Of course.
And, say, time in the saddle, which is so important. As like with all things, the only time generally in life that we get these meeting of heads is when the expectation doesn't meet reality. And too often that is the thing that doesn't align is Prem Rugby, English Rugby, club owners, directors of rugby don't all have the same expectation of what will happen and how people will be managed, because it's such a difficult number of circumstances to put into one melting pot and come out with an outcome that works for everybody. Whereas, as I say, if we could bring it together and have a season that is in line for everybody, it would certainly start to solve some of the issues that we're seeing. And if we could manage those expectations more appropriately, then it starts to make it more of a level playing field for people to understand what you can and can't get out of your players. And I think it would also potentially adjust what internationals, how it was structured around their commitments to clubs, and it might change things, but who knows, it might mean that there are different avenues which can be explored around how we utilise our international players.
Now then, what's happening? So why did you leave rugby?
And like a number of reasons. Number one, so we had... Was it? I'm just trying to think. So 2020, we had twins to go along with, as we spoke about earlier, and then 23-month-old. We had three kids under two. I very quickly following that turned 40. I'd had 9 years in the same position at Exeter, where it wasn't going to move because the coaching staff is so established there, and there wasn't really an opportunity for me to move forward. And this might sound a little bit silly, but I wanted to do something which meant I could help a larger number of people. I'm hugely passionate about people. I believe that humans can do incredible things. Given access to the appropriate information and resources, I just think that the sky's the limit. You really can go on and do anything you want to if you're given the right set of beliefs and an appropriate platform to work from. And so I set about a week after the twins were born, much to my wife's disgust at the time, looking at how I could take my skills, put it on a bigger platform, help a larger number of people, and bring together and construct something that we could put out and sell. Following that, it was end of season last year. I was looking at going to football, actually. But they said it didn't work out. And I had a year left on my contract. And because of the timing around COVID, the proposition which we had then put together, which is essentially a personalised health and wellbeing platform for corporates, which leverages a number of things, personalisation for people and supporting this like green agenda at the moment. So giving people access to something which means that they can help out with these things without it being a big effort. And I was like, well, if ever this is going to be relevant, it's going to be now. And I've spoken so long about these different constructs which create this sort of fulfillment, if you like, which is autonomy, mastery, purpose, put those three together. And I need to go and do it, and not just talk about it. I need to say, be true to my own word. And massive risk. I went out there, I raised a little bit of investment initially and went out and built the first version of the platform, which we launched a couple of weeks ago. So it took us 9 months to put together.
What's it called?
It's called My Day. So it's all about what people do with their day and how they can do small things which make a big difference. And that's on a number level. That's behavioral science and habit formation for an individuals, alongside accessing the appropriate resources and materials. And then on top of that, we reward healthy habits and behaviours with something they call carbon credits. Now, carbon credits are essentially how we can stop carbon going into the atmosphere, but it's like a registered certificate which businesses can utilize, and it's a way of doing something good for the planet, which is to me really important with young kids, as it is to you. It's funny, isn't it, how quickly kids change your perspective on things. Like all of a sudden, to use the rugby analogy, I want to leave the planet in a better position than I found it, and I want to find a way to do that on a large scale, because I'm scared shitless about what's going to be around in 50 years when I move on for my kids to enjoy. I want them to have the same privileges and opportunities that we've had and being exposed to without a downturn in their health. I don't want them to have to wear masks everywhere or worry about emissions of this, that, and the other. I want it to be a problem that's starting to be solved on a bigger level. Yeah, I went about this journey looking at how can I do something which can scale quickly, so which is why it's a digital platform. How can we reach a large number of people quickly, which is why I've gone down the corporate route. And how can we do something that supports mental and physical health? We've got mental health in my family, and I've seen what it looks like for people who don't have the appropriate support network, access to appropriate medication, friends, family, and the likes of. And we've built a strong trend of that through what we're doing. We've done it with a clinical psychologist. Yeah, I just thought it was time to get out there and take a bit of a risk in life, because it soon passes, mate. As you and I sat here both know, I very well remember. I remember playing against you a few times, actually, but like when you talk about it now, it's like 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And
it's a different life.
It is a different life completely. And I look behind you, there's a picture of me up there playing rugby. Thanks, mate. Coaching. Again, it's gone like that. That was 9 years of my life, which I invested into an incredible, say, nigh on decade, doing amazing things that money can't buy. And I just thought, I'm doing that and loving it, but I'm doing it for somebody else's dream, which I would never change 1 minute of. But I thought, I want to go out there and see if I can create something which can hopefully harness large numbers of people, create a bit of a movement and actually do some good. So, yeah, and that's the story for me. And like, it's got its challenges, but fuck, I love a challenge. If ever I loved anything, I love having the opportunity to go out there and do something that others haven't, you know, do something a little bit different and show people what's possible, show my kids what's possible. Because even if I fail, which I don't think I will, I've still gone out there and stood up for something I believe in, which is important.
Well, taking the risk, taking the lead.
Mate.
And I say that having not really done it myself, but been thinking about it. I had this thing by the time I get to 40, that I would have another string to my bow away from rugby. Maybe this is it. You know, maybe, you know, doing the interviews, doing the podcasting.
Yeah,
and I think it's having the bollocks to go and do it. If you can say bollocks now, it's 2022. Can you still say that?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you can.
You can. Yeah, well, I can. Yeah. For sure. Even though mine are pretty small. But it is. I mean, because you've left an environment that I'm sure you were comfortable, albeit uncomfortable, because it's a high performance environment, to go out without a team, you know, and to leave the pack.
Massively.
And that's credit to yourself and the fact that you've put it on the line.
I think that people forget what an incredible set of skills they are given by professional sport, how fortunate we are to live in that bubble. But what we don't necessarily allow people to understand is that they're hugely valuable commodities. They've got so much to give. Like I spoke very early on about that opportunity where you've got the guy who, if he'd never found rugby, may have had a very, very different path in his life to if he found rugby, making sure he's given that opportunity to be in a better position moving forward. And for me, guys need to understand that they're a valuable commodity when they're coming out of rugby. They've got an incredible skill set, which isn't given to many. So if they can harness that and find a way to harness that through their career, they'll be amazed at what they can do following on from that. Like you look at success stories that come out the back of rugby and what people have gone on to do. And all too often, we believe that that's the world, but I've very quickly learned once you step out of rugby that's only just the start. I think somebody said to me the other day, for context in sport, if you take the four major American sports, so baseball, hockey, NFL and basketball, the total revenue generated from that fits inside the cardboard box industry in the States. Everybody has got eyes which look into sport and admire it because of all these traits that we've got, but we don't necessarily understand how powerful that is and until we have to go and look for it afterwards. So my one word of advice to guys would be is, say, get on that bike early, find some things which pop your cork, light your fire, say, set off your Tom Thumb, whatever it might be. Say, go and find those things alongside it and genuinely believe they'll be amazed at what they can achieve.
Yeah. Well, rugby's the ultimate sport at any level when you look at it. The teamship, the values from all walks of life, all shapes and sizes, and it's going through a tough time at the minute. We won't get into that now, but the values in which it gives you, the levelers, the ups and downs. And again, that's obviously given you, it's given me a fucking life.
No, mate,
you know?
I'm so grateful to everybody on. I had 21 years in professional sport, everyone. Nigel Ray, we had Gary Heatherington and Tony Rowe. They all gave me incredible opportunities. And like we spoke about earlier, those things that money can't buy, it doesn't matter who you are, you can't be in those dressing rooms. It doesn't matter what you've done. You can't be living it with those people day to day, seeing them become players, team players, dads, husbands, and the rest of. And those to me are the things that I feel hugely, hugely privileged to be a part of, have been a part of. And now I hope I can go and create a team in an environment where we can push some of those lessons out on a larger scale to a larger number of people to give them a little bit of that resource, all being well.
That's class, Parksy. So if people want to find you, James Parks, where do they go? Where's the website?
Or LinkedIn's the best place to find me, mate. Say James Parks on LinkedIn. Anybody that wants to chat about anything, rugby, health, say that.
Human optimization.
Yeah, exactly. Like, because as we know, like, health's a massive problem, right? And we're looking at making sure we put in place preventive health systems to help make sure we can alleviate the, say, the stress longer term on individuals, but then second and third order consequences on the health systems in the within the world. But yeah, let's see what we can do, right?
And the name of the company again?
My Day.
My Day.
Yeah.
Wow, it's been a hell of a day. Parks could have gone all day. We'll do it again.
You're an absolute gent. Thank you so much for having me. I'm, say, really, really grateful, Jim.